Blog Let's do it. Radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, yeah. Friday, Saturday, 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. It's your main man, Marvin Rome, and a crew. I'm coming to you live. African American Empowerment. We're telling our own stories today. We got Dr. Bruce in the house, Brother George, Willie Lynch, Kwanzaa, you, me, and so much more. Come on and join us. It's family time. And y'all know there is no greater love and no better love than for self and time. No better love. Oh, oh yeah. No better love. And sisters and brothers to African American Empowerment Saturday. It is 365 days of you know what for you know who. It's African American Empowerment. And the only way that we're going to get the work done is to celebrate ourselves, to educate ourselves, to do the work of working on ourselves collectively and individually as well. We have to do the work. I want to get started by kind of outlining and framing why we do what we do. There's a cause here, right? And there's a work that needs to be done that reflects the challenges that we face as what they call African Americans, Aboriginal Americans, right? They are, in my mind, synonymous, and we are one and the same. And so there are different names that we are called by, and I'll get Brother George to jump into that a little bit later. But we have to find out the work that has to be done to manifest a change in the lives of so-called African Americans, to manifest a change in the status of our place here in the world, to identify and recreate a space for people of color, particularly what we call black people in this country and on this continent, that were marginalized, that were enslaved, that were brutalized, that were mistreated. Those days are over, right? And that is the thrust of what African American empowerment is simply all about. It's about the empowerment of African Americans to motivate you, to inspire you to do the work of working on yourselves, to do the work of re-engaging our community, re-educating our children on cultural traditions and lasting ties that would tie us back to something greater than ourselves. How do we do this work? Here at the NAAEA, we propose there are five ways to do that, but I want to talk about the show first. So when you see the introduction, right, you hear the introduction and we talk about the tenets of the NAAEA, it is really talking about the pillars of what make what we do work, right? That's politics, economics, athletics, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, culture, and education. It's five, but the culture and education are separate from the politics and the education, and the A is the athletics. We'll get to it. But then there's the Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment. That's Brother George bringing in what we have learned to know as Willie Lynch. And Willie Lynch, the history behind that is there are some practices that they developed to indoctrinate us, and we're breaking that. The Stan Macklin moment that talks about the tenets of the NAAE is for us to develop ourselves and redefine who we are. That's what it's all about. So you're going to get that every week, right? Then there's Young, Gifted, and Black. So when you hear that song, you should be inspired to say, we could do much more. Listen to the words. But there's also a call. There's a call for the need for change within the African-American community, within your community, but not only within the community, in the hearts and the minds of our people. We have to do that work. It's up to us, and we're going to have to figure out the work and then do the work. No one's going to do it for you. No one's going to save you. No one's going to come back for you. Not back for us. We are coming up, and we're coming up by doing the work. And if you notice on this show, we're not talking about anybody else but improving ourselves. Those days of blaming others are over. We know what they did, and now we're going to resource ourselves, and we're going to move forward collectively, right? Banding together to find the resources necessary to institute our institutions that create and define our own reality. That's what we're going to do. Whether it takes 10 years, 10 months, or 10 decades, we're going to do it. We're coming back, y'all. Yes, we are. And now for the tenets of the NAAEA. You have to have a political agenda. African Americans must have a political agenda. It's politics. Understanding global, right, national and local politics. You got to educate yourself. And that is the total sum of everything is education. Let's go forward. You have to have a political agenda and a political aspect that really looks at how we're going to integrate our minds into this society to utilize the tools necessary to free ourselves from the shackles and the chains of those tools within this society that keep us bound, incarcerated, miseducated, undereducated, and underfunded. Just have to. Period. Next, it's the E. It's an economic agenda because you need to understand and learn how money works. You have to do it. You have to do that thing. Learn how money works. Execute that and teach it to your children. The A is really simple. Take care of your body. Say more than that? No. Get an exercise routine. Get out. Work out. Eat clean and healthy. Push back from the processed foods. Y'all already know. For the C, it's culture. We need culture. We need relevant cultural programs that bound us, that anchor us in something that we believe in within ourselves. Chin up, chest out, we always say here at the NAAEA, because we need that. And then lastly, it's a comprehensive education that allows us to learn and grow, not only from the world around us, but from each other. And we can do it. All we have to do is just simply try. And now, Stan Macklin moment. We'll be right back.
Man, Stan, the deck is packed today. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah, man, we got the deck.
I just love it when you're able to explain the pillars of the National African American Empowerment Association. You know, when we have institutions that define our own reality, quit trying to get in to fit in, this is where it's at, and this is what we're doing.
Stan said it right. This is what we're doing. We have to understand that we have to create institutions that define our own reality. We simply do. The work is going to be up to you and me daily of committing to change. And we're going to have to be those change agents. We simply are. And now for my favorite part of the show, the Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment with Brother George. Y'all know how I'm bringing them in. Oh, yeah. Come on. Come on. That's it. Come on. We right here, Brother George. Welcome to the show. How are you, brother?
I'm doing fine, brother. I appreciate the introduction, and I appreciate the things that you said, you know, at the beginning of the show, explaining and defining, you know, the different segments of what we do here. And I really can't wait, you know, to hear Dr. Bridges' story, you know, because I know a little bit of it, and it's very fascinating. So, you know, call somebody, you know, and tune in, because his story, you know, is like it should be a movie. But today, from the Nguza Saba, the Kwanzaa principle is Kuumba, creativity. To do always as much as we can in the way we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited it. Kuumba, depicting a snake crawling up a rafa palm. This symbol represents ingenuity, excellence, and performance of great. Observing the most ordinary details of nature has inspired poets, musicians, philosophers, and scientists to make wonderful creations, inventions, and discoveries. We too can be inspired to new ways of thinking simply by paying attention to the natural world around us. Once again, you know, that's hitting Dr. Bridges all in the head, the natural creation. Today's Willie Lynch segment, I'm going to go back to something that you put a lot of emphasis on today, the Ten Commandments of Black Economic Power, Dr. Boyce Watkins. And this is commandment number 7. Capital must be preserved, protected, and efficiently used. In a capitalistic society, capital matters more than almost anything else. Capital isn't just money. Capital consists of any resource at your disposal that allows you to get things you need. For example, money in your bank account is capital, since you can withdraw it for emergencies, borrow from it, give it away to charity, spend it, or invest it. Other forms of capital might include what is called human capital. These are the hours of labor that most of our people are trained to give to big corporations. When these corporations hire you to go to work for them, they are renting your human capital. Other forms of capital might consist of your knowledge, your reputation, trust funds, real estate, stocks, and even your children. Farmers used to have a lot of children because more children increased their chances of economic survival since they could go to work on the farm. One of the most important rules of capital is that it must be protected and that it must be used efficiently. A good example would be the use of the football game, the game of football. The job of the quarterback is not scoring touchdowns. It's not making passes or handing the ball off to the running back. The number one job of the quarterback, first and foremost, is protecting the ball. This means that if the quarterback fails to protect the ball, there is no chance whatsoever that the team will be able to score a touchdown. In the same way a quarterback is the leader of his team, you are also one of the leaders of your family. Your job is to protect the legacy and build a better legacy for future generations. Protecting the ball for you means protecting the family's capital. This means thinking about how to ensure that more money comes in than goes out. It almost means gaining the ability to identify various forms of capital as they appear, so you don't miss out on the wealth that exists in your family. This is a great book, and it's a great guide for our people to follow to economic wealth, economic power, you know. And I get it with the farming and number of children, because in most of our families, you know, you go back a couple of generations, and it might be 10 uncles and 5 aunts back then, because they might have 15 children, you know, siblings, because that was necessary, because they didn't have the money to go and pay a bunch of people to do the work. So children, they weren't, all of them weren't children at the time, but the youngest might do, you know, minor little things, while the older ones did more laboring type work, but it was necessary for survival back then, and I think that's what he's alluding to. But Brother Marvin, that's me for today, unless you have a question.
Thank you, Brother George. Absolutely. This week's question is, you talked about protecting legacy. Anybody that's on this line right now or listening to this show, what do you recommend that we do today to begin to protect our legacies?
Well, the way that you can protect your family's legacy is how you carry yourself in the society. I I call my niece and my nephew number one. And the reason why I call them number one is because they, to me, were the best parents in the family. They got 8 children, and they do just about everything together. Their children do well in school, and they're well-behaved, and they speak well, and all of that. And they don't live in the richest of communities, you know. And my niece's husband, you know, my nephew, he comes from the island. So he brought that island culture to family building. And they've done a great job. And so what I say is, I told them, I said, the way that you bring your children up in the household, the things that you teach them, that's all they got to work with when they go out into the world by themselves. And so what you could do to honor the legacy of your family is conduct yourself in a manner that is respectful to the legacy that you come from. That's my advice, brother.
Thank you, Brother George. Once again, you have done it. Brothers and sisters, can you produce number ones? Think about it. We need more number ones in our families. We need more number ones in our communities. We need number ones like we need leaves on trees. We desperately need to create, build, develop, and transform our children into number ones. But they need good guidance. They need good parents. They need good leadership. No, wait. They need excellent leadership. They need excellent fathers. They need excellent mothers. They need excellent aunts. They need excellent teachers. They need excellent mentors. They need excellent friends. They need excellent neighbors. And we are going to have to produce those individuals, those mindsets. It's going to start and it's going to happen when we decide that that is what we want to do. And I'm suggesting that we start producing number ones today. You can do it. It's up to us. Let's continue to work on ourselves daily. Now, it's time for the show. We got Dr. Bruce with telling and recalling our own story. Today is an introduction to Dr. Bruce Bridges. You heard about the man. Oh, yes, you have. You heard about his book. But now it's time that you learn about the man behind the book and the mind behind that book and the man that was created and developed through all obstacles and challenges and changes to be who he is today. We got Slido in effect. Here it is, slido.com, 355-518. Join me on that. I want to see you today over on Slido. Also, 845-277-9250. If I said it too fast, I'll slow it down. 845, call in line, 277-9250. We're going to have a question to answer at the end. I'm sure you want to ask Dr. Bruce some questions or Brother George or myself. Again, Slido, slido.com. The code today, all you got to do is put these numbers in and start typing. 355-6518. And now, let's bring them in. Oh, yeah. So we got to do this, Dr. Bruce. Oh, yeah.
Bring it. What? Be right here. We're not going anywhere. Be right here. This is all that we don't share.
We ain't sharing. Right, Dr. Here. Bruce. Welcome to the show. How are you, brother?
Fine, my brother. Fine, fine. Good to be with you again this week.
All right. I want you to bring it.
Yes, yes, yes. And again, I'd just like to thank my predecessor from last week, Dr. Lafayette Maxwell, for a brilliant presentation and a brilliant discussion of his life and development in the city of Jacksonville, Florida. And to those who missed that program on last week, you might want to do like a friend of mine did and went back and listened to it. But you can listen in the archive, right, Brother Marvin?
That's right.
Right, right. And because it's a very good one, I think. That was an excellent program. And he actually gave me this idea of trying to do the same thing this week about myself, since people have been hearing me on this program for quite a while. I don't know how many months, Brother Mom, but we've been on for quite a while, going every other week discussing my book.
Yes, sir.
But when Dr. Maxwell came up with the prelude to his discussion that's coming up soon also on African-American theology and blacks in the Bible, he came up with the idea of talking about who he was and how he developed and how he became the person that he is today. And so I started thinking about it. Like old folks say, I got to thinking about it. And I said, it is very interesting that we tell our stories. So when he came up with that, he came up with a very, very good theme for a lot of good programs, telling our stories. Because if we don't tell our stories, who will tell it, bro? Brother Marvin, Brother Joe, if we don't tell our stories, we can't look for our oppressors to tell our stories, can we?
Mm-hmm. No,
or whether they're going to tell it right.
That's right. What say, Brother George?
No, sir.
That's right. We can't. So that's an excellent idea of having this thing, Brother Marvin, about telling our stories. And because none of us, whoever we are, no matter how old or where we are in life, we did not get to be the way that we are overnight. It was a process, a long process, many years of progressions and ups and downs and peaks and valleys and mountains and rivers in our lives that caused us to become the way that we have become as a people and how we developed. There's a reason for it. And as we always say, when you look at the psychiatrist or the psychologist, they first of all put you on that couch, let you stretch out, and then take you back to your childhood, because something in your childhood caused you to become the way that you are today. And if you are forgetting something, if that psychologist can bring up something that will trigger something that you can associate with or something that you've been taught, then it can bring you out of your depression or make you feel better about yourself or whatever the case may be. But it goes back to something that happened when we were growing up a long time ago in our lives in these United Snakes of America. So I thought that it would be good for me to follow the same way as Dr. Maxwell did. And quite similar to Dr. Maxwell, I grew up in a black community in Durham, North Carolina. And in Durham, North Carolina, I grew up in what they call, that Brother George and I always talk about this in Richmond and all over the country, grew up in what they call the projects. That's what they were, a project. They were working a project on us. They were doing a project. So they called them the projects. And the projects that I grew up in were called MacDougal Terrace, and they still exist today and are still called MacDougal Terrace. Now, I won't get into today, but I can't hardly hold it back, but I am going to hold it back, where the name MacDougal came from and who Mr. MacDougal was, but that's for another lecture at another time. But the name of the project that I grew up in was, or is called MacDougal Terrace. And growing up in MacDougal Terrace, grew up in a fairly large family, as Dr. Maxwell said he did, 7 children, and I was the oldest of 7, and single-parent household for the most part, double-parent household very, very, very briefly, but both basically a single-parent household, and around all black people, didn't hardly see any white people at all, unless it was a white man who was coming through the neighborhood selling sheets and spreads and products to brighten your furniture and products to wash your clothes and those kind of things as they used to come around the community, those peddlers. And so for the most part, that was it in terms of white people. Even the little store that we had in the community that was located next door to a barber shop and located next door to a beauty parlor and next door to a washerette, that store was run by black men and black women. And that's one thing, too, about growing up in Durham, North Carolina, in the projects called MacDougall Terrace. Durham, North Carolina was a type of town, as I talked about on last week, and to those who may have missed it, I'll repeat it. It was a kind of town where you saw black people doing things, like Jackson Ward in Richmond, Virginia, like Tulsa in Oklahoma, like Boley in Oklahoma, like the streets in Dreamland, as it was called, in Arkansas, and the part of town that Dr. Maxwell talked about where he was from, down in Jacksonville, Florida, Black Bottom. In Durham, North Carolina, we had Hayti. So as a youngster growing up from MacDougall Terrace and having to go shopping, of course, we went downtown to the white stores sometimes, but a lot of the things that we wanted were right in our neighborhood in Hayti. And when I say our neighborhood, not in MacDougall Terrace, but in the black community of Durham called Hayti. In that particular community, there were several businesses, and businesses that sold furniture, repaired shoes, businesses that sold and repaired watches, of course, beauty parlors, barber shops, about three African-American theaters, movie theaters, about three in the Hayti section of Durham, North Carolina, one called the Wonderland, one called the Regal Theater, and another one called the Booker T Theater. The Wonderland, the Regal, which means royal, and the Booker T after Booker T Washington, you see, because black people at that time had examples that they could make out of heroes in their community. We didn't have to use the heroes from the white community, so we called the theater Booker T after Booker T Washington because he was a hero. So just about grocery stores, funeral parlors, of course, pool halls, just about everything that we needed was found in the Hayti section of Durham, North Carolina. And as I talked about also on last week, Hayti was named after Haiti in the Caribbean islands, because when Haiti became independent in 1804, under the leadership of Toussaint L'Ouverture, and became the first black nation in the United States of America to become independent, the first time a group of black men and women soldiers had defeated the great French armies of Napoleon Bonaparte, everybody was ecstatic. Black people everywhere around the country were ecstatic. Wow, did you hear about that nation of black people down in the islands who defeated Napoleon Bonaparte? Oh, man, they defeated them, and now they're independent. They got their feet off of their necks, and they're independent, running a government on their own. So black people were very excited, Brother Marvin, Brother George, to hear something like that. And so when they heard it, that became a symbol for us, a symbol of progress, a symbol of moving forward, a symbol of being able to defeat white people and let us know that if we organize, we can defeat the oppressor. We had symbols to look at, as Brother George talked about earlier in his discussion. So that's what Hayti was. Hayti was a part of Durham, North Carolina, that, as Dr. Maxwell, I keep referring back to my brother, that was destroyed as these black communities were destroyed all over the country. So African Americans coming up after the destruction of these black communities like Jackson Ward and Second Street and the black community in Washington, D.C., down on George Avenue and in that area with Ben's Chili Bowl and the black community there. And same thing in Harlem in New York. Harlem now is turning white in New York. Used to be the Mecca for black America, you see. And Harlem in New York, and, of course, in Chicago, the black community was called Bronzeville, you see, bronze after black. So we had symbols that we named our communities after, and had men and women who were teachers and preachers and businessmen and businesswomen and who were doing things who were symbols for younger people coming up. So these are the kinds of things that actually aided in my growth and development. Growing up in a segregated community in Durham, North Carolina, and also understanding and getting a chance to shop in Hayti. Then, of course, going to Burden School, which is a small school in Durham, North Carolina that still exists. It still exists. And in looking at these schools that I talk about in my book, in the preface of my book, to those who have my book, I talk a little bit about what we're talking about today. And I talk about how I also have very vivid memories of the secondhand spelling books from the white primary schools, because this is what we had. We had white primary schools that donated books to the black schools after white folks stopped using them, and they had written in them, and they were used in secondhand. They got new books. So, of course, black people got the hand-me-downs. They gave us their books to use. So for us to have come out of what we came from and to have progressed as much as we have, even though some people say we still have a lot to do, which we do, but we are people to be reckoned with, and we are people to be grateful, and a people also to understand that we are a great, proud, and beautiful people to have come to where we are now and looking at what we came out of as we go back to it. For example, as I said in my book, images of people in the spelling books were always white. Not only were the images in the spellers white, but when we read about Alice and Jerry, Dick and Jane, the dog spot, everything that we saw was white. And to those who are tuned in and who are old enough, you remember this. And then I continue. As I say in many of my lectures around the country, the only thing black was the spot on the dog name spot that we saw. But when we left that environment, we could go back to our black community. We could go shop in Hayti. We could go buy ice cream from the black man who had an ice cream parlor in Hayti. And we could go to the black theater on Saturday morning and see the white cowboys in the black movie theaters, you see. So this is what we came up in, you see. And as I talked about in my book, church and school. And as Dr. Maxwell said, church was a major part of my life group. Not really a major part of my life. I don't think as much as Dr. Maxwell in Jacksonville. But church was a part of my life. Sunday school every Sunday. Church after Sunday school. And couldn't wait to get out of church and to go get an ice cream or soda or something, you see. And then we went to church. We did use those books that had white images in the Sunday school books. White images were on the walls of the church that we grew up in. But, as Doc said last week, we saw those images, but they didn't really bother us a whole lot, or at least we didn't think so, because we saw other images outside of that when we left the church and left the little books in school. We saw images and symbols for us to aspire to when we went to Hayti and when we went to the movies and when we went to school and to listen to our black teachers who tried to put in as much as they possibly could into our classroom. Now, of course, they couldn't put much into our classroom, but they would slip in some Booker T. They slip in some Harriet Tubman. And, of course, they slip in some George Washington Carver, because he was a very meek and humble man. But at the same time, he was a great scientist, you see. So we saw that part of him, which was good. He wasn't a Nat Turner or a Denmark Vesey or wasn't even a Harriet Tubman or a Sojourner Truth. But he was a great scientist. So these are the kinds of things that we saw when we were growing up and that we heard in the classroom. And when we went to church and listening to the preacher, and most of the times we went to church to give us a chance to wear a new suit of clothes or to get a chance to talk to the young sisters who'd be dressed up and those kinds of things. So church was not just a chance to hear and learn about the Bible from the perspective of white people, but it was also a chance to commune with your brothers and sisters and other people in your community. It was a place of enjoyment. It was a place of endearment. It was a place that we got together for recreation, you see. So that's what it was. It wasn't necessarily what was being said in the pulpit, because most time, I won't say most time, but a lot of us didn't even know what was going on in the pulpit. But we knew that Mr. Jones, who sat on the other end of the pew, was a friend of my father, and he worked on our gas heater, or he did something when it came to delivering some groceries or whatever the case may be. So there was that was an outlet that we had there in the church. And to those who are just tuned in, who may have tuned in late, we're following the theme that Brother Marvin came up with called Telling Our Stories, and I'm telling the story today of part of it, really, of my story today. And, of course, going to the segregated schools in the elementary and also in the junior high school, and then going to a segregated school in junior high and elementary school, it was a big difference after leaving Hillside High School in the seventh grade and going to Whitted School in the eighth grade, and then leaving Whitted School, which is, and all these schools were black, Burton in Durham, Hillside in Durham, Whitted in Durham. All these three schools were African-American schools owned and operated, even though now the teachers had to follow what the Board of Education was giving them. And, of course, it was not anything from a black perspective, but a well-meaning teacher could bring in whatever they, you know, could put their hands on or whatever they could find to give to these poor little black students that were in their classes. Now, here's the big change that happened in my life when I went to high school. I was a part of integration. I was a part of a project to try to mix black children in Durham, North Carolina, with white children in Durham, North Carolina. So black children from MacDougal Terrace, black children from Hickstown, black children from North Durham, black children from Brookstown, black children from the West End, these black children from Cornwallis, these are some of the communities in Durham. These children were beginning to be bused into a white environment. And I think that this is where my awakening first began. Going to the white high school and seeing white teachers and listening to white teachers and being able to, at an early age, pick up on what oftentimes was subtle racism. Sometimes it might not have been subtle. It might have been blatant racism, or just outright racism, blatant racism. I picked that up at Durham High School. I saw that early in the ninth grade at Carr Junior High School before going to Durham High School. Pardon me. I saw that. And then after going through junior high and high school, and I recognized, too, that white people in Durham at the high school I attended had a swimming pool, but they covered the swimming pool when they found out that the black kids were coming over to Durham High so they wouldn't have to swim in the water with us. So they covered up the swimming pool. Nobody could use the swimming pool. We don't want y'all in the pool. Get out the pool. You can't get in the swimming pool, you see. So I began to see those kinds of things. And then, too, when we look at it during the early, mid, and late 1960s, the black power movement was beginning. Black people were trying to integrate at first, and blacks in Durham started what was called a boycott of the downtown section of Durham, North Carolina, under the leadership of a man by the name of Howard Fuller and the leadership of another man by the name of Benjamin Ruffin and some people named Howard Clements and Sister Ann Atwater and Sister Valentine and her husband and so many other people's names I can't recall, but these are some black people who were participating in the boycott in Durham downtown, asking black people not to go into the stores in downtown Durham because they're not hiring black people. Why should you stop and spend your money, stop and shop and spend your money somewhere that you can't even get a job? You can give them your money, but they can't give you any. It was a one-way street. So we were boycotting, and I used to see people standing in front of the stores, Lerner's, Cress's, Talheimer's. Some of these stores were all over the country. These same names that I'm calling were all over the country, and black men and black women were standing in front of these stores with lists and asked black people who were going downtown to shop, don't go in these stores. If this store is on the list, we'd look at the list, and we say, I'm not going in there because our leaders are asking us not to go into those stores. And I saw this when I was coming from Durham High School, because in order to get home to MacDougall Terrace, I had to go through downtown. And so when I saw that, I said, oh, man, this is great. I became inspired by seeing black men and black women standing up and trying to be conscious and trying to be self-determining and to begin to question the system. So I became a part of it at a very young age. I became a part of this and started getting with the older brothers and sisters when I was in high school and late junior high school, and I would go down to the office of Benjamin Ruffin and Howard Fuller and pick up my flyers when I come out of high school, and then I'd go out and join a post and stand in front of the store and pass out leaflets just like everybody else was doing. I didn't understand everything and all the politics and everything behind it, but I knew that what was being done was something that was right for black people. So that was a tremendous part of my upbringing. And also I recall every Sunday night when we had those groups standing in front of stores during the week, from Saturday through Saturday. Stores were closed on Sunday, but from Saturday through Saturday, we were standing out in rain and snow and hail and sleet and hot sun. We'd stand in front of those stores downtown, black people would, who were part of the United Organization for Community Improvement, as it was called, the UOCI. We would stand in front of the stores and pass these leaflets out and ask black people not to go into these stores. And then on Sunday night, very strategically, the black church would open up and would allow us to have what we call Sunday organizational meetings, where we would get together and have a keynote speaker and talk about the progress that we had made the week before. And every week, these meetings were held at a different church in the black community. So when we start to talk about the church, we have to look at the church with a different light. We understand, when we begin to get some consciousness and understand the images and all those kinds of things, and we understand the theology, and the theology should be from a black perspective and should not be a white theology and blah, 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 and we should study Howard Thurman and we should not study some of the other white theologians. We understand all that. But at the same time, we have to understand that the black church would always open its doors for us to have community meetings to discuss our progress and to strategize as to how we were going to move forward. The black church was there, always there. The black church was there for poor people who needed something in the community. The black church was there with its mutual aid societies and various other kinds of things. And I think this is where, and of course he can speak for himself, is trying to make Dr. Maxwell understood a little better. It's what he's trying to make us understand. And we also, at that time, because of what was going on in the country, the whole climate was different from what it is today. These gangs that we have, East Coast versus West Coast, and North versus South, and Crips and the Bloods, and all these gangs, they may have been going on back during the day, but not to the extent that they are now. And so what happened is that the climate was of such that people would sing about consciousness. Everything was about being black. Think about it, brothers and sisters, and to those who are tuned in. People began to wear afros. They began to wear dashikis. They began to wear total African attire. They began to discuss issues and have meetings and forums talking about what was going on. You see, people came out of all that, like Sister Angela Davis. George Jackson came out of that in the Soledad prison, he and his brother. Matula Shakur came out of that. And by the way, of course, he was released from prison. I hope the brother is still doing fine, but he's out on a medical release. But Matula Shakur, the stepfather of Tupac Shakur, he came out of that. Angela Davis came out of that movement. Kathleen Cleaver, wife of Eldridge Cleaver, came out of that. And what we also need to understand is that students, these people were students. Most of these people who I named were students. Huey P. Newton, before he picked up a gun, was a student at a community college in California. Bobby Seale was a student at that same community college, and they organized and became buddies and friends, and even more so than that, became brothers in the movement and started the Black Panther Party, because the consciousness was of such a great and high level that everybody was trying to do something black. Wouldn't it be great if we could get back to that? But white America saw what was happening. So they began to pump drugs in and began to try to get Huey involved in crack cocaine, pump the marijuana in, pump the heroin in, and the time began to change, and the black consciousness was taken over, and black people began to move more towards integration and to lose our own businesses. And that's another long story we can talk about later. But these were young students, which is my point, who were black studies. People today are talking about critical race theory. The reason we're discussing critical race theory is because back in the late 60s, Nathan Hare and some other people from other schools and colleges in this country at Howard University demanding black studies be taught. That's why we have a critical race theory. This is why our history is important. Critical race theory is nothing really new, because Nathan Hare, and he's still living, by the way, was one of the early people who people early on who were responsible for having black studies in America. And, of course, I have vivid memories of looking at the pictures of the brothers who were taken out of the buildings, the administration buildings, in various colleges and universities around the country. Black people on those campuses, white campuses, would organize and take over, get guns and take over the administration buildings at colleges and universities, and demanded black studies and demanded that we be seen and taught our culture and our heritage. And not only that, many black teachers today need to understand why it is that they can teach at Harvard. Why there was a Cornel West at Princeton, or why or Rutgers, or wherever he was, or why there's a Henry Louis Gates who does BlackAncestry.com, or why there are black professors and chaplains at Harvard and Yale and Wellesley and some of these other colleges, University of San Francisco and UCLA. These black professors are there because of what the brothers and sisters did in the movement of the 60s demanding this, and now they make these high salaries and they think they are doing something on their own. But we as people have to understand that we are part of a foundation that we stand upon that caused us to be what we are today, and we cannot forget that. We have to understand those pictures, man. I just love seeing those pictures when brother, I can't think of his name, brother with the dark glasses and the big afro and had his gun, his ammunition stripped around him when he came out, after he came out. Black folk were serious at that time. We weren't taking no prisoners, you see. So this is a part of my development. And then, of course, going to NCCU, and I'm going to, as Brother Mom said, don't have to tell it all today. I can't tell it all today. And going to NCCU after being all that in my background, then I went to North Carolina Central University and started seeing black people, black students at North Carolina Central University from small towns who had not been exposed to some of the things I had been exposed to, going into classes and referring to their professors as their Catholic professors as father this and father that. And I thought that was asinine to refer to a white professor as your daddy, father this and father that and mother superior and mother that, because a lot of our colleges had white professors. And black people, of course, being taught to respect anything white, we referred to them as we gave them the utmost respect. But I questioned that. So I have always, from a very early age, some way, somehow, I don't know why, but I had a questioning kind of mind. And I think it really came from my mother, who did not graduate high school, probably did not graduate junior high, but who always questioned things. And somehow just naturally or innately ask questions. And I think I got that from my mother's side of the family, to ask questions and to try to not to accept in and everything. And so that was a part of my development. Brother Marvin, I'm going to stop right there, and we can come in and give you a chance to ask some questions, because that's as far as I got. I got, you know, up to North Carolina Central University. Haven't even graduated from that yet. But I'm going to stop and get me a glass of water or something, that you go ahead and give it back to you and take questions of how we want to roll with it from here.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. Thank you for sharing your story. 845-277-9250. Slido is pretty hot today.
Oh, yeah, part of my story. That's why I want to take some questions, because that'll get me into some other things, man. But it's so much. And let me just say this, Brother Martin, before you go. One thing I really, really feel kind of bad about, that is, I really don't think that our young people who are in positions today, positions of local, city, state, national government, in certain places of power and prestige, I don't think they respect what has gone on before them. I really don't think so, and that kind of bothers me. Back to you, Brother Martin.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. And again, 845-277-9250 if you want to come on to the line, call in line, or you can go over to Slido. And again, Slido is pretty hot. We're going to get you back over here in a minute to answer some of these questions over here, Dr. Bruce. But in the meantime, again, it's Empowerment Saturday, African American Empowerment Saturday, 365 days of this, right? Education, culture, and much, much more. Going to be up to us, right, to look back, right? Go back and fetch it. We're going to have to do the Sankofa thing. Look back and see what happened to us, right? We're talking about community, right? Dr. Maxwell talked about that he was raised in. And it is clear that our children are in a different climate and a different culture now. And so as we reflect back to the things that we have now, they are definitely in a different light and a different disposition and a different energy in this modern culture, exposed to technology and all kind of things. And how do we get the benefit and the usefulness of technology while guarding our kids from being assaulted by so much knowledge and having others to have access to the minds of our children? It's just a thought. Dr. Bruce, you ready to go over to Slido before we go to the lines?
I'm ready, brother. And you know, that reminds me too, Brother Marvin, I was talking about how the climate was different and how you mentioned too, it's a different climate. When he asked me, was I ready? And I go back to Dr. Maxwell, because we came up a lot of light. I like, though, you know, we like even the songs that the entertainers even had some sense. They would have positive messages and music and in the dress, and everything was just a positive kind of climate. And when you say, are you ready? That reminded me of a song written by Eugene Record, who was the lead singer for the Shy Lights. And they made a song called Yes, I'm Ready. It's called Yes, I'm Ready. Are You Ready? And that song was really talking about integration and talking about busing and talking about black people leaving their side of town, getting on buses and going to the white schools. And the song says, It starts talking about a schoolhouse across town, the city parks and playgrounds where children join hands, and then it goes on. I can't remember the whole thing. But then it says, yes, I'm ready. Yes, I'm ready if I don't get to go. So to answer your question, yes, I'm ready if I don't get to go.
All right. Well, let's get going because we've got some questions for you. All right. The first question on Slido is, who is Mr. Dougal? McDougal. Who is Mr. McDougal, Dr. Bruce? You got to tell us who that is.
As I said before, Brother Marvin, I will get to that a little later because it's not so much who Mr. McDougal was, but it's another piece of research that I'm doing now that I have not let out yet, and I'm going to let it out. I'm going to, as a matter of fact, what I intended to. And that's why I got to talk to my good sister again. I've called her. I know she'll get back with me as soon as possible. I've returned her call, Sister Benita. I'm going to call a press conference and reveal some things about the city of Durham, which a lot of people don't know when it comes to these names, and also not just Durham, but some of the other major cities and towns in North Carolina, even though it expands outside of North Carolina. So I don't want to get into McDougal. It's not so much about Mr. McDougal, who he was, but just the origin of that name McDougal itself and where it came from and how that relates to our culture and our heritage and how it's been covered. So anyway, let's move on.
All right. So we're working inside the Telling and Recalling Our Own Story series with Dr. Bruce, and we're introducing ourselves to Dr. Bruce today, and he's introducing himself to us as well. So the next question is, does Hayti still exist? And the question that follows that is, what was Hayti a symbol of and what happened to it? Two questions on Hayti.
Okay, first one, does it still exist? Not, well, some people might say it does, but not really, not like it was. In Durham, North Carolina, there are two shopping centers, one called the it's called Phoenix Square, and the other shopping center is called Phoenix Crossing. They're right across the street from each other, but it's not what Hayti was. And Dr. Maxwell kind of briefly talked about it on last week, but white people built those expressways through the black community, destroyed the black buildings, and said, and then put us in some little tin shacks in another area of Fayetteville Street in Durham. And then when they put us in those tin shacks, they promised to rebuild Hayti. And as he said last week, that rebuilding has never taken place on the same level that it was at the time. So to answer that part of the question, no, it does not exist as it once did. Then there was another brother who tried to start a Hayti heritage community and put some stores there, but no, not really. Not like it was. No, sir, brother, no.
All right, we're talking about highways and urban renewal. Those were the strategies. All right, let's go back to Slido. Before we go to the lines at the top of the hour, 845-277-9250 is the number. Slido.com if you want to reach out to Dr. Bruce as well that way. Back to Slido. It says you mentioned the word commune as a part of community. How do we get back to community?
I guess one good way, Brother Marvin, is to do what we're doing today. And for you and Brother George, myself and Dr. Maxwell and others of us who are working with your project to just keep doing this and getting, and see, the main thing we need to do, I think, is to first of all start thinking community, start thinking black, because if we don't start thinking that way, we can never become that way, because everything that you see in this world began as a thought in the mind of some human being. Everything that you see that has been built or that has been done was first a thought. So until we begin to think black and to think about doing for self, even though times have changed, I know it's very difficult because integration is here. As you said, too, you got Slido, you got Instagram, you got TikTok, computers. You got integration. You got black men marrying white women. You got so much mixing. You got a Mahomes and a... And who has a white mother and a black mother, and they all, you know, so we're so mixed up now, and so it's very difficult to do it, but we have to try as best we can to do it today. But it is a lot more difficult, and then those who are not marrying into the other race, or men, black men marrying white women marrying black men. Then you got black children who are being adopted by white parents like Colin Kaepernick. Of course, most of them don't come out like Colin Kaepernick, got their heads on straight. And I was talking to somebody this week, I was commending Colin Kaepernick because, you know, a lot of times brothers like that, when you see them, they got a white woman. But Colin Kaepernick, he's got a sister, and he's standing up for being black, and he made a statement, which I really liked. Some people say he shouldn't have made it because the people raised him, and they did raise him. But he said that he was always missing something with his white parents. And he said that what he was missing was that blackness was not there. And he talked about and gave an example of his hair. He said when he wanted to start wearing braids like the brothers, his white adoptive father said, "You don't want to be like them folks," and that kind of thing. Mm. Even though he was feeding him, clothing him, sheltering him, and adopted Colin Kaepernick, but at the same time, Colin Kaepernick was not getting what he wanted from that interracial relationship. That's another good topic, too. But dealing with all this kind of stuff nowadays, we didn't have to deal with all that then, but we're dealing with all that now. Okay, let's go to another one, Brother Marvin.
All right, last one, and then we'll go to the lines right at the top of the hour. We don't have hand-me-down books or schools anymore. We were better then, and we were hungrier for knowledge and education. What we need to do now?
All right, first of all, as I said before, it starts with a thought. We got to first of all realize that we're not getting pure knowledge and education. And I was watching something last night, a video, and I mean, I have to even go back and question my so-called education because there is so much, I can't overemphasize it, so much that we have missed and are still missing in these schools that people like DeSantos in what he's trying to do in Florida and when Trump came in and what Trump tried to do with everything that Obama had done, trying to dismiss and get rid of all that, we are still not being educated. I'm not talking about degrees. We got degrees, no doubt, but we're still not being truly educated. But first we have to realize we're not being truly educated, and then when we realize that, then we can go on a journey. We can start reading, start going into internet, start using all this stuff that they've given us that's used for our good now, and educate ourselves and get some of this information, even though it's becoming very difficult, and put into the classroom, because some teachers now, from what I've been hearing, are very inhibited about trying to give out information because they might lose their jobs. They don't want you to teach critical race theory. They don't want you to teach this. Don't want you to teach that. So, hey, it might be a call for us to start our own schools, as Brother Lush has said, and to have our own standards as to who teaches at those schools, when or whether or not they've gone to white people's schools and got those degrees. If they have the knowledge and have the information, turn them loose and let them teach our young people growing up in the basement of a church or wherever it might be, or in a room in somebody's house. But we might have to get back to that because the system not educate us. Thank you, Brother Mike. Cut me off. I know you got a lot of calls. Please cut me off.
No, you go right ahead. This is your show. 1683, you up next, first and on deck. Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Bruce and myself, Brother George? 1683.
Good afternoon, brothers. Peace, everyone. It was the sound of my voice. As always, beautiful, beautiful listeners. Dr. Bruce, I'm sitting here thinking, he's talking about me. Growing up in projects, demonstrating, protesting, seeing things as a child, being exposed to white folks through integrating the school, going to a white school when I went to the ninth grade and all. I said, you're laying out my life, you know. It's so familiar. But, I just want to say, and this is my humble opinion, that I realize, and this is something hard for me to realize and accept, just like it is for us as a people. Since slavery, since the emancipation, I feel we as a people been fighting for the wrong thing. We've been fighting for acceptance, We've been fighting for integration. We've been fighting for to be equal to our masters. That's been the premise of all our movements. Acceptance. Let us show you that we like you, Master. Let us show you that we can handle these things, and we let you don't slam the door in our faces. Don't close your shops to us, your restaurants to us, your schools to us, your swimming pools to us. You know, just open it. Let us ride up in the front of the bus next to you. We've been fighting for the wrong things. What we should have been fighting for all along, and today is our freedom, not acceptance. Not integration, not equality to my master. No, free me. I want my freedom. Let me have that, and then we'll go from there. Don't give me these other things. All the things we've been fighting for, and I've said it before, is that the things that the white man has always wanted us to have to begin with. He just made us fight for them to look like he given us something, and we are winning something. We are accomplishing something when we're actually not accomplishing a damn thing. He's just setting it up for us to look like this is what you're going to fight for and call it our civil rights. You know, I heard someone once say, I don't want no civil rights. I have God-given rights I was born with. I don't need you to give me civil rights. I was born with these rights. And then that leads me to my next comment. Our culture. We don't know our culture, and we don't. How do we get back to our culture and so forth? Well, again, to me, in my humble opinion, our culture is our nature. That's who we really are. Your culture is who you are. Be who we are. Be your kind, loving, respectful, honest, caring self. Be, as we used to say, brother, be the one. Be who you are. Find out who you are. Discover yourself and reflect that, and that's your culture. Your culture is just who you are. It's your nature, your righteous self, your loving self, your good self, not an evil person, not a lying, stealing, murdering, cheating, adulterous, all these things. Be yourself. Find yourself. Find the God in you. That's your culture. Right. Your nature. You don't have to label it Africano, black, or whatever, Negro. Your culture is your nature. Is who you are, brother. That's the point. Those are the two points I wanted to make briefly today, brother. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Dr. Bruce. Thank you, brother. You want to follow up anything on that?
No, not really, brother. Nothing. Just to say one thing, I agree with your brother 100%. Some people, some conspirators came among us and told us that integration would be better. But what actually happened is that when we enter and see what it made it real easy, because going back to, and all this still relates to my book, Recapturing the African Mind, it made it easy for us to. Made it easy for us to buy that argument of integration, because we'd always been taught that everything white was better than anything black. So when you are given an opportunity to participate, as brother said, to be accepted, using his word, or to be involved in anything white, then you're going to take that chance. So if white people are going to say, oh, yes, now you can sit at my lunch counter. Oh, yes, now you can sit in the front of the bus. Oh, yes, now you can stay in my hotel. Then we're going to do that because we think that what they have is better. And it may be better, but it became better because of our input into that, and that's why it's better today. But had we not bought that bill of goods, that counterfeit dollar that they gave us, and thought that what they had was better, and put our own money into our own communities and stayed to ourselves, there's no telling what we would have had today. Because look at what we had going on then. Look at what was happening out in California. Look at what was happening in Los Angeles, the black strip in Los Angeles. Look at what was happening in Arkansas. Look at New Orleans. Look at Alabama and North Carolina, Haiti, Jackson Ward, and all over the country, Detroit, Black Bottom in Detroit, Michigan, and Bronzeville in Chicago, where the numbers and lottery actually started among black people. Look at what we had going while not bargaining with them. So what happened is this integration worked better for white folk than us because they now not only get their dollars, which they were going to get anyway, but now they get our dollar. So they're getting their dollars and our dollars. They're getting it all. There is, and then I'm going to be quiet, but there is a reason why these white college basketball and football teams can win these championships is because they're getting the best of the black players and the best of the white players. Can you imagine what would have happened, what would happen if Michael Jordan had gone to Hampton University as opposed to University of North Carolina? Can you imagine what would have happened if Shaquille O'Neal had gone to the university, to Delaware State University, as opposed to LSU? Can you imagine what would have happened if Earl Pearl went to Winston State? But can you imagine if all the black athletes did not have to, could not even go to white schools? Let's say we're not going to let you go to our schools. If Shaquille and Raouf and LeBron James, because he didn't go to college, but if all these black athletes that we know, Steph Curry, and all these black athletes had to go to black schools, can you imagine what black schools would be now? White folk would come to us to get what they need as opposed to us going to them to get what we need. That's another lecture, Brother Mom. You got to cut me off, man. Please cut me off.
Amen to that. Here's a tie-in right from Slido from Dr. Maxwell last week, the brother just now, and Brother Booker just now, and you. It seems that no matter where you were or grew up, things for us were still the same. So there's a common thread that seems to be running through each of these communities and cultures as we talk about Haiti and Jackson Ward and Black Bottom. It's really very interesting. All right, let's go back to the lines. 252, first three, last three, four, I'm sorry, 5347, you're up next on the empowerment line. Do you have a question or comment? 5347.
Hey, brothers, how y'all doing?
Doing fine, brother.
Hey, yeah, this is Brother Reg, man. pleasant greetings to you guys today. I'm getting ready to get out here for a meeting, so I'll make this very brief. Brother Marv, your monologue was great, man. I think culturally, Dr. John Henry Clark would be mildly, more than mildly, pleased at what you were saying, and Dr. Claude Anderson from the economic side would be greatly pleased at what you were saying, and you and Brother George, your tie-in there when you first came on, it was great, and Dr. Bruce, with your humble beginnings, I know it was a definite thought that you had to put in your spirit to stay with your training, you know, making a decision that you will stay internally with your people and with, because you could have sold out and just taught what the book wanted you to teach in school. But you, I've seen that you stay internally, wanting to deal with what your people wanted you to teach. And we thank you for a brother like you. And you keep on with the good work. And Brother Marvin, good job you're doing. And you guys just keep up the good work. But I'm glad to get out here to go to a meeting. And I appreciate what you're doing, man. You guys have a blessed day. All right.
Thank you, Brother Red. Keep plugging away. Go back to the lines. And thank you for the compliment, Brother Rich. 206, you're up. 3175, you're up next. You're on live with Dr. Bruce. You have a question or comment on the empowerment line?
Yes. How you doing today?
Hey, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Yep. There we go. Sounding good, bro. Yeah. Brother Bruce, man, you got a jewel of this gentleman. I went to, I lived in the same projects in Durham, North Carolina with Dr. Bruce, about a block and a half up this hill from Dr. Bruce. And he's been this way since he was a young man, all full of knowledge. I don't remember. I forgot what age she is, but I'm in my mid-70s right now. But he has it all knowledge. And his book, Captain of the African Mind, everybody ought to get it. Everybody ought to get it and read it. What he says about Durham, North Carolina is true. The urban renewal, like it did in other communities across the country, they bought, I guess, right now they call it gentrification. They bought buildings in, improved neighborhoods, ran black folks out, what they call in Seattle, they had a thing called weeded seed. They weeded black folks out and seeded white folks in. And you see this happening all across the nation. But I'm enjoying the show and just listening, driving down the street in Seattle, Washington. That's where I live.
Great show. All right, welcome,
and
Seattle.
Since Seattle is on there, okay, so Brother Frank, Seattle, glad you called in, man, and Brother Marvin and Brother George are always, and me also, I feel like I'm becoming a part of this whole, I'm real close in this family with Brother George and Brother Marvin. They're always looking for good guests, and I was telling them about you a while back, and a good program would be that Black Radio, and Brother Marvin and Brother George, this is the brother I told you all about who grew up in my neighborhood and who, from the time he was about 18 years old, I was younger, you know, behind him, but he was about 18. I've never known him to do anything but be in radio, and he's in Black Radio right now with a Black radio owned and operated radio station in Seattle, Washington. He's on the air there. So he's a jewel that you need to keep, Brother Marvin. I might forget it, so jot it down. He's a brother that you might have as a guest one day. And also, he's from Durham, so he could talk about the black community out in Seattle. But anyway, that's another time. Let's move on. Thanks for calling, Brother Frank.
All right.
All right. As a matter of fact, Mr. A telephone man, you have to cut Brother Bruce off. Brother Bruce, lots to talk.
All right. Thank you, brother. Thank you. And let's see if we can connect later about collaboration.
Let me off, brother.
Thank you, brother.
Let me off.
All right. Let's move up to 804-5416. 5416, you're live. Do you have a comment or question for Dr. Bruce? 5416. Go on once.
My comment goes to the impact that integration had on our people. We always thought that the white person's water was colder. You know, we always thought that what they were offering were better. When they were actually, the truth be told, they had stolen, for the most part, what we had invented and changed it and said it was theirs. We need to teach our roots, our heritage. I would like his comment on whether integration had helped us, which is a certain class or a certain age of black people thought it would, or whether it has hurt us.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for calling, as usual. Dr. Bruce, has integration done its job? Dr. Bruce, there.
Oh, man, thank you. Thank you. I was on mute. I was talking, but I was on mute. My answer was that integration has definitely hurt us as a people, and I was saying that that would be a good discussion for us at a later date to talk about it, because we kind of keep going back into it by talking about the black communities all over the country, and Brother Frank out in Seattle was talking about it. So, yes, it's hurt us. You know, so it's another good discussion for another time. I agree with the brother 100%. But it helped white folk. It helped white people because they get the best of everything that we have now. The best of everything that we have. Everything. Our women, our children, they get the best of our athletes, our entertainers. They get everything that we have now. And anyway, like I said, it's another subject, so why would I not go by what I said? I'm saying it's another subject, but I'm still talking. Go ahead, Brother Marvin.
All right, Brother Marvin. Thank you, Brother John.
Brother Marvin,
can I jump in? Yes, sir.
Dr. Bridges is responsible for
the 200-plus Black Book Library, Black Books and other libraries that I possess. And I credit him for that. And I really appreciate that. What I would like to ask him, in light of the fact that he has written the outstanding book, Recapturing the African Mind, does he have another book in store for us in the future? Because the show is about your history, so I wanted to ask that question to you.
All right. Good question, Brother George, and bring us right back to the topic. That's right. We were going into integration and some of everything. You're right. But, yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I got a couple that I'm working on now. That's why that question about the MacDougall, I didn't want to go into it right now. And I also mentioned something about a press conference with some information on this town and some other towns in this state, which has been completely obliterated, completely left out. And so, yeah, I do. To answer your question, I really do, Brother George. Because, you know, a white man said something one time years ago, and I was at a lecture at the Stanford L. Warren Library, which is another part of the black community in Durham. Durham, unlike a lot of cities, had its own black library, and it was called Stanford L. Warren Library. And Stanford L. Warren Library was named for a man, Stanford L. Warren, which I won't get into now, who had a connection with the white family of Dukes in Durham, Duke University and Duke Hospital and all that. The Dukes were tightly, tightly intertwined with black people in the community of Durham. And as Dr. Rogers used to talk about before he went on to the ancestors, Stanford L. Warren kind of came out of that. As I said before, I won't get into that, but Stanford L. Warren was a black man who has a library, and the library was named for him, but anyway, his mother used to work for one of those Dukes, so we won't get into all that. But anyway, that particular library helped me a lot. There's a brother, and he used to listen. I don't know if he still listens or not. His name is Adrian Neely, but he always would say whenever he came to the library, he'd always see me in the library reading something in the corner back when we were maybe, 12, 13 years old, you know. But libraries are very, very, very important, and I appreciate Brother George for, you know, saying what he just said. So something that was another point I was about to make about something he said, but I lost it. I can't think of it now. But, yes, libraries are very important, to know our culture, to know our heritage, and to understand where we came from. But nowadays, hey, we got libraries and we have other forms of education if we'll just take advantage of them. Yep, no question about
it. Reading has paid off because you definitely has been a great wealth of knowledge for a lot of us who have learned so much from you. Let's go back to the lines. 919-5825-5825-5825-919. Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Bruce? 25, you're live on the empowerment line. Maybe they're just listening, Dr. Bruce. On them 919 numbers. Your people down there. All right, let's go to 919-3347. 3347, you're up next. You have a question or comment for Dr. Bruce. 919-3347. Another good listener. Let's go on over to 919-58. No, I'm sorry, 8502. 8502. You're next. Have a question or comment for Dr. Bruce.
Good afternoon, Marvin, Brother George, Brother Bruce.
Yes, sir.
This is Herbie White in Durham, North Carolina. I was born and grew up in New York, but I had relatives in Durham and they lived in Hayti, and I came down every summer. So I experienced a lot of Hayti. And where you could go down on Pettigrew Street and go to the Regal Theater and enjoy a movie, or you could go across the tracks to the White Theater where you had to pay at the box office and walk around the side and go up the fire escape and sit in the balcony. Mm. So going to that White Theater told you that something was wrong with you. That's why you had to be put in a different section. So the Hayti community that made you feel like somebody needed to be destroyed.
So fast forward to the No Bookstore, Dr. Bridges' bookstore. And it wasn't just a bookstore and a restaurant. It was an African cultural experience.
Yes.
When you walked in the store, there was people in the store that you didn't know, but they weren't strangers.
Right.
You immediately started to react to each other and communicate with each other even though you didn't know each other. And then you could go over on the other side and get you a good meal, and Brother Bruce would play some old Soul Train videos while you're eating your food. So the No Bookstore had to go. So it's not so much of us wanting to be around them. It's about them destroying what we have.
That's a good thought, Brother Herbie. Was it them destroying what we had, or was it a combination of us wanting to?
I didn't
want to
go downtown.
Like the brother said, I heard that. All right. All right, we're going to try to squeeze in one more before we wrap up. Thank you, Brother Herbie. Let's go over to 0148-0148. That's 334-0148. You're next. You're live on the Empowerment Line. Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Bruce?
Thank you for taking my call. Real quickly, if you can, Dr. Bridges, would you include 1 Samuel E.B. Du Bois Cook, who was also very instrumental in Durham, North Carolina, in your studies, if you would, please, sir?
Hold it, Brother Lush. Now, help me out. Maybe one I've forgotten. Who is Samuel Du Bois Cook?
Samuel Du Bois Cook, I understand, was the first black professor at Duke University. He served as president of Dillard University. I had an opportunity to meet him when he served as president back in the 19-somewhat.
I do know about him. I'm glad you remind me. Like Brother Marvin said, so many things, Brother Lush, I have really forgotten. Yeah, but you're right. And he was a part of the Cook family in Durham. And as a matter of fact, he had either his wife or his sister or one of his relatives, probably his daughter, was a music teacher in Durham, North Carolina. And the Cook and my sister used to take music under Miss Cook. She was a music teacher, and they had a son also named Logan Cook, who became an entrepreneur in Durham and who was a part of the integration with me that went to Durham High School. Now the Cook you're talking about, I remember now, but he was so far. He was back. What's some dates on that Samuel Cook, Lush?
He was president of Dillard somewhere in the area of 1975 to 1990 or 1999, somewhere about.
He was early in Durham, right. And he left at an early age, I think, to go over to Dillard or to travel to some other places. But and his daughter, as a matter of fact, lived right in front of North Carolina Central University, the one that taught music. And anyway, he has a son who's a biology teacher down in Atlanta, Georgia, right now too. And before we go, there's a daughter also of his daughter's daughter, I think, and I'm trying to think of her first name, but she's a renowned harpist in some orchestra in California. I can't think of that Cook first name, but you're right. They were very prominent family in Durham, North Carolina. And that's another thing, too, about Durham, which was, as Brother Marvin said, we don't have to rush this thing. But Durham was, as Dr. Rogers used to say, he'd be smiling in his grave for me to make this point, Durham was and is very, very color conscious, light complexion, dark complexion, and not just Durham. It's all over. The lighter you are, the better you are. Those combs they have at the church, when you go into
that's
the church,
all I can
got
do.
Thank you, brother.
That's all
there
I
you
can
go.
Do. That's all I can do. All right, let's wrap it up. Dr. Bruce, we got about 50 seconds. Thank you, Brother Lush. Round of comments.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, Brother Marvin, my final comment is just for people who are tuned in, please tell some other people about this program, share it with some friends, with some relatives, and to look forward to some more of telling our own story. And remember, on the 24th of this month, Dr. Maxwell will be back, and he'll be talking about black theology. So Just make this program a part of your Saturday afternoons, wherever you are. Thanks, Brother Marvin.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. It's all about African-American empowerment. You can't beat it. Great show today. Thank you. Come back next week. Peace and blessings. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Brother George. Till next week. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.